See you later. It's yours now. You got no one to blame but yourself. So how would you advise them? Well, if you want one person's take, that's what this book's about. Leslie Stahl read this of CBS, 60 Minutes, and she wrote me a letter saying she found it engrossing, creative, and funny. And I said, I'll take all three, given the size of the book. Now, the book develops the kind of strategies and tactics, the speed of confrontation and collision with the mounting counterattack by the corporate bosses and their Washington allies that I think are very realistic. It is the amazing when you're dealing with a fiction that could be nonfiction, you tend to urge things you would never urge because the people would say, that takes money. The people would say, that takes organizers who have to be paid. It takes media, which you're not going to get. So once you take those out of the equation and you say, yes, there is money. There is money for organizers. There is money for buying sub-economies. There is money for a People's Chamber of Commerce. There is money for a mass network of TV and radio stations. There is money for people who are lecturing and conversing with as many as 1 million people a day personally. Once you deal with that, all kinds of strategies and tactics that we have repressed because, quote, they can't be funded. It's unrealistic of you. Become practical. And there's a point in this book which Warren Buffett turns to his assistant. They fly back and forth from a mountaintop hotel in Maui. That's where they cloistered themselves. To plan every month. He says, you know, we've done all this on less than one third of my net worth. Less than one third of my net worth. Just like George Soros. For $150, $200 million. Why are we not holding these people up to their appropriate civic responsibilities and financial capability? Since for the most part, they agree that our country needs redirection. We're not talking about 99% of the super rich. We're talking about a few nationally and more, but still very few locally. And some of them will be mega billionaires, some of them will be multimillionaires. Some of them can do something for localities, some of them can do something for the nation. Some of them shift power in a very fundamental way. There has never been a social justice movement that has not been preceded by a demand by the powerless to shift power from the few to the many. So they have a lot of pressure, a lot of tension in here. You'll finish this book, I hope, feeling stronger as a citizen. Whatever discouragement you had might be less. Whatever cynicism you have possessed might be receding. And you might say to yourself, why haven't we talked with these people? Why haven't we talked with these people? They often let us know where they stand. We're talking about the tiny, tiny minority now of these super rich. How many do we need? 150 million bucks to 200 million could have stopped the Iraq war. $1 trillion wasted, lives in Iraq, 1 million people dying, blown country, contaminated, destroyed, riven with sectarian conflicts because the invader sided with one against the other and passed out $100 bills and divide and rule. Look what's happened to our soldiers. They've been brutalized. The ones that come back alive have been brutalized. And often their families have felt the brunt of that, post-traumatic syndrome. And we haven't yet begun to pay for the veterans and their ailments. $150, $200 million. Where's our imagination? Where's our sense of going to someone like George Soros and say, you've thought of a lot of things that made you rich. You thought of a lot of things of starting citizen institutions. You put your money behind it. You just may not have thought about this. What about bringing these 300 together? You get your calls returned. Let's take prison reform. You know how much money is pushing behind Senator Jim Webb's proposal to establish a commission to study prisons and all their horrors and wastes and commercialization and brutalization and recidivism? You know how much money is behind his effort just to do a study commission? Virtually nothing. You don't think there's a mega millionaire in this country who would like to reform our prison system? Sure there is. But people aren't going to these people. They're not putting it on the table in front of them. These super rich people are amateurs like all of us. They don't really know how to make change. But they have a lot of change. And once they start thinking about it, and once we start thinking about it, once our expectation level goes up, suddenly we find ourselves very creative in how to make change because we have the resources for it. The abolition movement against slavery, you will recall from our history, was funded in no small part by rich, proper Bostonians and some New Yorkers, including people who helped fund Frederick Douglass, whose immortal phrase, "power concedes nothing without a demand," ought to be memorized by every school child in the country. We often forget that the modern civil rights movement was significantly funded by rich families, the Curry family in Virginia, the Stern family in New Orleans. Somebody had to pay for organizers, for litigation, all the way to the Supreme Court. Somebody had to help pay for transportation, for rent. It's expensive. Nowhere near as expensive as the forces arrayed against them, but $1 behind a form of justice that reflects public sentiment can counteract $100 from the other side. As Lincoln said, with public sentiment, we can do anything. And without it, we can do very little. And my contention in this book, and there's a lot of dialogue here, in this book you see how the mounting groundswell that was heading toward the East Coast began to confront conservative thinking and conservatives. And I think you'll be intrigued by the interaction and what happened as a result. There is a story like this in most of you. I suspect that most of you have been engaged in civic activity of one kind or another. May I see the hands? Okay. I suspect some of you have not won all the time. And when you lose a battle, whether it's initiative or the stadium fight or whatever, you've got to get rid of this top two nonsense here if you want dissent to be reflected in the political system. You lose a battle, what goes through your mind quickly? Oh, if we only had more media. Oh, if we only had more people on the ground, canvassing, leafleting, organizing. Oh, if we only had more money. If those are the questions that go through your mind, you've got a story like the one in this book. Maybe localized, maybe even more instructive. This is not a novel. It has never been conceived as a novel. It will never be read as a novel, and it will never be remembered as a novel, I hope. This is a work of political imagination we're all capable of from our own experience. And I hope it generates a new genre of fictional writing that could become nonfiction by raising our imagination to envision and our expectation level along with our morale. I read, when I was a child, teenager, I read a book called Looking Backward by Edward Bellamy. Some of you may have read that. That was the spectacularly famous utopian novel. That was a novel. By a Bostonian that came out in 1886. And it helped fuel the populist progressive movement because it posited a United States of America more than a century in the future where there was no poverty, there was prosperity, justice, and so on. And it excited people because it gave them a scenario. Everybody knew it was fiction, but it gave them a scenario because it was explained in understandable terms on how they ordered the society. Year 2000, actually. The writer should have extended it another century, probably. And Eugene Debs used to quote it. You know that it sold 1 million copies in hardback. It was one of the bestsellers of all time to that date. And people would talk about it in bars. It was incredible what it did. How many read Looking Backward, Edward Bellamy? Yeah, I didn't find it the most exciting book. But then I'm reading it in 1945, 1950. I'm not reading it then when you look back at that period in the Industrial Revolution and the dungeon factories and all the turmoil and the struggle of workers. The interesting thing about Eugene Debs, who was a great man, I think he was one of the greatest men in American history. He spoke out against World War I, which was one of the most preventable wars, and Woodrow Wilson's attorney general threw him in jail. In jail, he got 1 million votes running for president. I mean, that's like 3 million today. He's the kind of man who could take a train from Baltimore to Chicago to make a speech in a field, 200,000 people show up. So obviously he was an indefatigable campaigner for the working people of the country. Where there were mass strikes, where there were general strikes, he was there, Eugene Debs. And near the end of his career, a reporter asked him, "What's your greatest regret?" And he looked at the reporter and he said, "My greatest regret? My greatest regret is that under our Constitution, the American people can have almost anything they want. But it just seems like they don't want much of anything at all." How would you like to be that reporter? Get an answer like that. That's our problem today. We are misled, underled, and we're lied to. We now are confronting a phenomena that can be encapsulated in one word in Washington, D.C. Obama Bush. His military and foreign policy is nothing we looked forward to. We all wanted him to succeed. Some of us knew that he had a serious character deficiency of being conflict averse. He does not like to challenge power, and he doesn't facilitate the engagement into power of people who supported him. Some of you may have heard of Dr. Quentin Young. He's 85 years old. He was one of the founders of the National Physicians for Healthcare, single payer. He's a good friend of Barack Obama's. Taught him a lot about organized medicine and hospitals and health insurance. They had many a dinner together. Barack Obama becomes president. As far as Barack Obama is concerned, Quentin Young doesn't exist. He was never invited to the White House for one of the dozens of meetings that were attended to on invitation of the White House to discuss health care and health insurance reform. Obama invited the head of Aetna 6 times, personal meeting. The CEO of Pfizer Drug Company, 6 times, personal meeting. Quentin Young, 0. That's what I mean by a character deficiency. Barack Obama, before he became a politician, by his own words, believed in single-payer health insurance. Full Medicare for all, everybody in, nobody out, free choice of doctor and hospital, and much more efficient. In foreign and military affairs, when you have a personality and a character like Obama, you are not going to take on what Eisenhower warned us about in his farewell address, the military-industrial complex. You're not going to reverse a foreign policy of empire. You're going to expand the war in Afghanistan and say you're going to get out of Iraq. How can you say you're going to get out of Iraq and not be called a peacenik by the warmongers, soft on terror? You expand the war in Afghanistan. The war in Afghanistan and now into Pakistan will never be won. It will just fade away after endless destruction and deaths and injuries, mostly on their side. The Taliban will probably, in all its diversity, continue pressing for negotiations with Karzai, will continue trying to have bases there. There'll be continual turmoil. We'll have our drones there, where people in Nevada, 9 to 5 and 5 to 1, you know, it's an 8-hour job. They push buttons and blow up people, most of them civilians, including wedding parties. This is being done in our name. Are we entitled to be angry? Are we entitled to be ashamed of ourselves? Are we entitled to break our routine? Are we entitled to stop making excuses about people not being powerful? Aren't we entitled to start putting some muscle behind we the people in the preamble to the Constitution? The last time I remembered, it wasn't we the corporation. Can we continue to make excuses for ourselves? Can we deny that if 2 million people in this country decided to make the end of these criminal wars their principal civic hobby, they could stop them? That's what it would take. You just try it. Spread throughout the congressional districts. Most of the people in the Democrats in Congress want to end those wars, and more than a few Republicans. But who surrounds them every day? Lockheed lobbyists, neocons, yahoos on cable TV, Rush Limbaugh types, draft dodger Rush Limbaugh types, PACs, political action committees, contractors, Blackwater, Halliburton, the corporate law firms represented them, the PR firms represented them. Where are we? We're voting for American Idol. Where are we? Where are the people? 2 million organized people can do it. Who's going to organize them? When I was a kid, my father would pose questions to us, and one of them was, why throughout history have the few dominated the many? His answer, the few are organized, the many are not. We outnumber them. We outvote them, and we can subordinate them to the informed will of the people. The problem is individual biology. The problem is because we are not more than one person, it's easy to say, what can one person do? It's not like we are congealed 1 million people, and when we eat, it goes through all our capillaries, and if the brain says go, 1 million people go. No, there's 1 million people composed of 1 million separate biologies. And those separate biologies have grown up in a corporate culture that has made them brilliant in rationalizing their own futility. And you've seen it in 100 different ways in your own experience. I finally reduced it to four excuses, but you can probably add. Why didn't you turn out? Here are the excuses. Why didn't you turn out for things you believe in? Okay? Nobody's trying to get you to cut your teeth on some mission that you disagree with or don't know anything about. Why didn't you turn out? One, I'm too busy, I don't have the time. Oh, okay. Let's say you're not too busy and you do have the time. Excuse number two. Excuse number two is I just don't understand how to do it. This jargon, it's parliamentary procedures, these lawyers throw stuff at us. I just don't know how to negotiate the system. Okay? Let's say you have the time, you know how to negotiate the system. What's your third excuse? Third excuse is, I don't want to be slandered, and I'm afraid of retaliation at work if what I do is something the boss doesn't like. Oh, okay? Well, let's say you have the time, you know how to negotiate, you're not blistered by moonbeams, and you don't think you're going to be retaliated at work. What's your fourth excuse? Fourth excuse is the closure. Fourth excuse is, even if I had the time, even if I knew what to negotiate, even if I didn't fear retaliation, it wouldn't make any difference anyway, because they will decide. They will decide the power structure. And then they go back and live their private lives, ever more under pressure. And when they become 70 and 80, they look back and they wonder why they missed the justice train. That's what we have to caution young people about. There's a tremendous vacuum of dissatisfaction if you've just gone through life getting a good standard of living and getting your leisure and your recreation and the job you have and not standing up for what is quite widely portrayed as a deteriorating planet, a deteriorating nation, and a deteriorating community, even though the McMansions and others keep going up. So, someone once asked me, what's the biggest problem in this country? I said, insufficient amount of civic motivation. If we're not civically motivated, we just live our private lives, and the civic and political arena become harsher, crueler, more vicious, more destructive, and it begins to spill over into lessening the quality of our private lives. So that's why I called one of my groups that I started Public Citizen. It comes from ancient Athens, where people got up in the morning and they improved ancient Athens. They were called public citizens. And we need more public citizens. We need more people, and I urge you to communicate this to others, we need more people to say to themselves, I'm going to spend an average of 5 hours a week on my civic pursuits. Doesn't have to be 5 hours every week, but that's roughly what it would be. Now, how many of you have met serious bird watchers? Can I see the hands? You know what a serious bird watcher is like, right? Up at dawn, into the marshes, binoculars, phones, gloves, pads, pencils. Ah, got one. Now, what if we had serious Congress watchers? There's a story in here about this. Now, what if we had serious Congress watchers? I mean, let's say someone knocks on your door and says, hi, I'm your new neighbor. I just want to introduce myself. I spend 22% of your income, can let corporations rip you off and endanger your health and safety and that of your family, raise or lower your taxes, and send your children off to wars. Nice to make your acquaintance. See you later. What would you say? Hey, come back here. You mean something to me, so I better mean something to you. You could say something else. You could stand there at the doorway and say, why you? You interrupted me. I was updating my profile on Facebook. Okay? So, How much time do we spend on Congress? Let me tell you how to turn Congress around. It is so easy to strengthen the people in this country into a deliberative democracy if people had the civic motivation to spend their time and their talent and their sense of fairness and justice. It's so easy. We have so many solutions on the shelf. We have energy solutions, housing solutions, food safety, nutrition solutions for our children especially. We have solutions about how to deal with fossil fuels, occupational disease, medical malpractice, you name it. They're all there. How to turn an inner city school into a thriving exercise of curiosity and inquiry and learning. We know we have them. They're all on the shelf. Some of them pilot projects, but we don't have a diffusion mechanism. That's one big thing we're lacking. We have a best practice here, a best practice there, but we have a diffusion mechanism. So let's say, okay, here's how to turn Congress around. It's in here, by the way. Let's say 2,000 people in every congressional district. That's about 900,000 people. Every congressional district has 630 or 650,000 people, men, women, children. Every congressional district, 435 of them. Let's say 2,000 people, and by the way, every congressional district but six has a college, university, or community college, or all of them. So let's say 2,000 people. It starts out with 10 people. They get together in a living room. Imagine a living room. How about that farmhouse in 1846 in upstate New York when six women started the women's suffrage movement? They must have been dreaming. What hubris, what arrogance. It happened. Just like Rosa Parks in 1955 in Montgomery, Alabama, was sitting in the front of the bus, and a white man came and said to her, and she said, "I'm just too tired, sir. I'm staying put." They called the police, handcuffed her, took her off to jail, ignited the Montgomery bus boycott, and helped launch the modern civil rights movement. How many black people in Montgomery, Alabama knew what Rosa Parks knew? Every one of them. By the way, a 15-year-old girl preceded her and refused to go to the back of the bus. But she didn't get the fame. Everyone did. So what makes Rosa Parks different? She had fire in her belly. Without fire in your belly, it doesn't matter what you know. You're not going to break your routine and take that risk for justice. That's true for the sit-down workers in Flint, Michigan, Warren, Michigan, in the 1930s in the GM plants. They put their entire family livelihood on the line. There was no unemployment compensation. In the Depression, not likely any job, because they wanted the dignity of forming the United Auto Workers for a decent workplace and pay. Fire in their belly. Where's the fire in our belly? You've got fire in your belly. You wouldn't be here tonight. It's a nice day. The sun is out over Seattle. But you know how many people don't have fire in their belly who agree with you? It's like pulling teeth to get them out. That's what we have to overcome. That's not done by email so much. That's done by personal conversation. That's done in living rooms. That's done person to person, persons to persons, more persons to persons. So let's say it starts out with 10 people in a congressional district. Then it goes to 20. Then you lay out the 2,000 person scenario. Each person pledges 200 volunteer hours a year. Each person pledges to raise or contribute $200 a year. Okay. This money will open up two or three full-time offices in the district with full-time advocates, and you develop a pre-agreed-upon agenda let's say single payer, living wage, etc. So there's minimal bickering down the line. You agree on a platform, and then you match the fervor of serious bird watchers. And watch what happens to your member of Congress, who up to now has very little to worry about you. As long as they flatter you, fool you, flummox you, as long as they gerrymander districts so they don't have to worry about the opposing party, it's either slam dunk Republican, slam dunk Democrat. That's the majority of congressional districts. As long as 95% of them get reelected every 2 years, automatically, why should they worry about you? They worry about the auto dealers here. They worry about the insurance agents. They worry about the restaurant lobby. Why should they worry about you? You're not organized. And year after year, your interests are subordinated and atrophied and repudiated and overcome. And before you know it, you become cynical. You say pox on both your houses. Half of you don't even bother to vote. And the rest trudge to the polls either as hereditary voters or voting for least worst of the two. Year after year, that's the death knell of any pretense of democratic elections, small d. Now, what's 2,000 people? I know bowling leagues in congressional districts bigger than that. I know mahjong clubs together are bigger than that. I know bridge clubs bigger than that. You see, we don't grow up this way. We don't grow up civic. Our schools do not teach civic skills. They teach computer skills and computer skills and more computer skills so we can have millions of young people spending half their waking lives looking at screens. And if they don't look at computer screens, they're looking at TV screens or they're looking at video game screens or they're looking at this little gadget. I think if there's ever a statue of the early 21st century young American, it will be walking like this. Yeah? So, I hope you read this book. I hope it motivates you. I hope you write your own similar story of political imagination. And I hope you start getting 10, 20, 30, 40. We turn Congress around, that's the beginning of the rise. Congress is the most powerful branch of government, even though it surrenders it to the presidency and to the courts. It doesn't want the responsibility that Madison and Jefferson gave it. But if it ever gets restored, you turn Congress around, it has the appropriations power and the tax power and the health and safety power and the declaration of war power. I mean, there's nothing compared to the Congress of the other branches. You turn the government around, it starts affecting the state governments, local governments, other people get ideas and they realize, you know, it's pretty much fun and it's pretty much gratifying to restore the sovereignty of the people. And you hand something to your children and your grandchildren that you're proud of. I mean, what is more humiliating than 30, 40 years from now with these deteriorating trends? Your young grandchild, age 9 and 10, sitting on your knee, and you're the grandparent. And, you know, they're just at the level of awareness where they see this world is in trouble. And they ask the most straightforward questions. Replace the White House pest corps and put 10-year-olds in there and you'll get a better result. They ask very straightforward questions. And so this little girl, this little boy is looking at you and sitting on your knee, says, Grandma, Grandpa, what were you doing when all this started crumbling? What are you going to tell them? A lot of people are going to have an empty taste in their mouth, if not a sour taste. I think it's very sad to go through life without pursuing a more just society and a more just world. I think that can be the ultimate gratification outside of family. When you think of how great talents are trivialized in this country, brilliant lawyers trivialized with derivatives and mergers and acquisitions that don't do anything for our economy other than make a few people rich. How brilliant chemists are put to work by food companies to develop the latest prize for a chemical whip on a bakery product? Actual case? When those brilliant physicists are producing weapons of mass destruction, which has now been announced last week by our government, will be able to kill anybody in the world in 1 hour with precision? How brilliant biologists were put to work under government contract, working in universities, creating more virulent forms of dengue fever before Nixon put an end to biological research, warfare research in the country? And right now, how many young people will go into the commercial world and be fairly well paid, but after they retire, they can look back and they say, oh, I guess my talents were trivialized. They weren't used for noble ends, for solving the great important problems of the world. Commercially, corporations are not addressing the great problems in the world. They're spending far more of their efforts creating them or intensifying them. The tobacco industry, chemical industry, coal industry, oil industry, drug industry. Try looking at the drug industry without government research and development. 3/4 of the anti-cancer drugs are developed with your tax dollars, given away free to the drug companies out of National Institutes of Health. The biotech industry, the semiconductor industry, the aerospace industry, the containerization industry wouldn't be anywhere near where they are today without your tax dollars and government research and development. Trillions of dollars over the last 50 years. The great problems of the world will be done by civic efforts, political initiatives in a democratic fashion, whether it's abolishing poverty or dealing with housing or dealing with preservation of our biosphere and the environment, you name it. It is not going to be done through the commercial world. The commercial world may adapt to it, may obey it, may reap its benefits, may distribute it, but it's not going to be generated, with very few exceptions, from the commercial world. I urge you, if you buy 2 copies of this, give it as gifts. It's a great Mother's Day gift. You get this one free. This is by a remarkable CPA, who is quite elderly now. And he did the most elaborate social accounting of corporate profits and corporate losses by taking into account all the damage to the environment and the fraud and cranking it in to a comprehensive accounting of a corporate performance. And he shows the damage is greater than the benefit. But the damage creates more demand, like making more people sick because of pollution creates more demand and more jobs for health care, for hospitals, for doctors, for ambulances. His name is Ralph Estes, and his last work is a book on how to begin to challenge and hold accountable corporations. It's extremely specific. It's like a toolkit. And you get this free if you have 2 of these. Now, you might wonder why you haven't seen me on Bill Moyers, Diane Rehm, Terry Gross, Charlie Rose, public radio, public TV. What's wrong? I ask you to answer that. These public TV and public radio, the nationals, are so intimidated by right-wingers in Congress, from which they get their meager budget, and are so solicitous of corporate donations, they're putting more right-wingers on who would like to destroy public radio and public TV than the people who defended them in the hard times of past years. And I say this because there are a lot of other people who are being kept off public TV and radio, whose names you know and whose authors have been here, of a progressive bent. And just as a side request, I hope that you will send your protests and your demands that these people appear more often, like Bob Kuntner, Bill Greider, Jim Hightower, Gloria Steinem, and others. And if they don't hear from you, the intimidation of the right wing will continue, and we will indeed find that the slogan public broadcast system has been transformed into the petroleum broadcast system, which is the nickname in Washington. Last point, and then we can have a very good discussion, I hope. I thank you for your patience. I hope that you'll work on the schools, the elementary and high schools, to get them to adopt civic skill courses. I'm not talking about traditional civics with dull textbooks that are so dull that when you read them, it's like swallowing a pound of dust without butter. And we all know what that means. They're afraid of controversy, afraid of proper names, very sanitized. That you will encourage teachers, and if they have any role in that, principals, superintendents, boards of education, to install civic skill courses starting in the elementary school. We have idealistic students. They're wonderfully curious. They will respond to connecting the classroom with their community. The laboratory for civics is the community. It's full of challenges, problems, and intriguing intellectual searches, whether it's the supermarket, whether it's the local factory or office building, whether it's the use of energy, whether it's town hall, whether it's the tax system, whether it's a waste dump that fifth grade students in Salt Lake City in a class one day heard one of their classmates say, there's a waste dump three blocks away and it's covered with shrubbery and bushes. And they all said, what? And the teacher said, what? And to make a long story short, she turned it into a class project. Indeed, it was a waste dump. They held a news conference. They met the mayor, the city council. They cleaned up the waste dump. The kids then testified for a Superfund law before the state legislature. And she got so excited as a teacher, she wrote a little book called Kids in Social Action and How to Do It. And she just came out with an update. So if we do not rescue this young generation from the electronic gadgetry that has turned into a narcotic and an addiction, if we don't rescue them from 10 years of age, spending 7.5 hours a day, 7 days a week, looking at screens, according to a new survey, if we don't get them into reality, into their neighborhood, conversing, exchanging, learning about the history of the community, and developing the civic tools, from the Freedom of Information Act, to how to build a coalition, to how to get information out of City Hall, to how to diffuse voting records, to how to become resilient, to how to share credit, to how not to get discouraged, to how to make your last defeat your best teacher, going through the ages with more sophistication. We're going to lose this generation beyond our wildest nightmares. They're being raised by corporations, fed by corporations, entertained by corporations, manipulated by corporations, defrauded by corporations, and rendered ignorant by commercial values predominantly crushing the civic values that we all treasure for our future and our posterity. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. It's your turn now. If you would like to announce some meeting you're having, don't hesitate, some rally. And if you'd like to make a comment or ask a question. Yes.
Why isn't the society that you've portrayed so accurately, why is it not going to end in either massive enslavement or a bloodbath?
What's the last phrase?
A bloodbath. Why isn't
a bloodbath. Oh, I mean, here you're asking me to hope to the contrary. Basically, because I think there is a critical mass that develops resistance. I mean, you push people so far, they don't do it. You push them further, they don't do it. You push them further, and then the leaders start arising. It's like Cindy Sheehan. I mean, she became nationally known after she lost her son in Iraq, and she parked out by Crawford, Texas, where Bush was spending part of the summer, and she demanded to know why. Why did her son have to die? What was he trying to prove in Iraq? And so, see, she went beyond her breaking point. So the key is the breaking point. What is our mass breaking point when we start resisting and building and taking over in terms of our sovereignty of the people, we the people? And what is our individual breaking point? And the mass breaking point is connected to the individual breaking point. So I say to progressive Democrats who opposed us in the campaign, they would say, we're with you. We love your agenda, but we can't have another Bush. Okay. So you got Kerry, and what's your excuse for Kerry not winning? And you got Barack Obama. And now they're criticizing Obama every day, and I just sort of, isn't that interesting what you say? How surprising. And they're criticizing him, foreign military policy, too concessionary to corporations, etc. Turning her back on labor with the car check. Remember that one? I just was traveling to Seattle, and the car in front of us had two bumper stickers. Said, Obama Biden, 08, and right next to it, the car check bumper. Have you heard of that? Huh? He said to labor in return for their support, and by the way, $400 million of contributions to his campaign, he said, I'm with you on Karchuk. All the way. He has never mentioned it. He has not proposed it to Congress. He hasn't put it in any speeches. How could he turn his back on the labor union? Simple. Because he knows they have nowhere to go. And when they signal they have nowhere to go, they have no breaking point. If you have no breaking point, you have no bargaining power. If you don't draw the line, you have no bargaining power. They'll never look back because they know they have you in the pocket. So the answer to your question is, tell me where the breaking point is. What is the breaking point? Huh? Is it invading Iran? Arresting 300,000 Americans with funny-sounding names and dragnet enforcement and throwing them in prison without charges? Is it torturing? Is it spying on millions of Americans without judicial approval? All of which is being done now and under Bush. It's just different rhetoric. Barack has wonderful rhetoric. But you think the CIA is that much different? Huh? They've actually feel empowered more under Obama. Recent articles have pointed out in what they're doing overseas. You think Blackwater has been cut off from any contracts? They were cut off in the latter part of the Bush administration and Obama from Iraq. But guess what? They have contracts in Afghanistan and inside Pakistan. So what's our breaking point? That's what I keep asking people. What's your breaking point? If you have no breaking point, then both parties are going to get worse every 4 years. And both parties will allow the corporate state that Franklin Delano Roosevelt called fascism in a message to Congress. One, government's controlled by private economic power, he said to Congress, that's fascism, 1938. Both parties will get worse. Country will continue to decline. What's your breaking point? Everyone should have a theoretical breaking point. You can say, I'll take this, but no more. How many people have a breaking point? How many people don't have a breaking point? If you don't have a breaking point, you've lost your moral compass. I don't care whether you agree with me or not. You have to have a breaking point. Whether you're a libertarian or a conservative or a liberal, whatever you want to label yourself. If you don't have a breaking point, you have no bargaining power. They can turn their back on you and turn it into a worse situation. That's what the message was during the presidential campaign. Didn't matter. However, we proved the brutality of the system against dissent, against third parties. We've got it documented. My campaign manager, Teresa Amato, in 2004 has written a book called Grand Illusion, The Myth of Voter Choice in a Two-Party Tyranny. And we've got court decisions to document it. So we've done that at least. They can't flim-flam us and say, hey, this is a democracy, you know, two parties. We've got it very well documented. When you challenge the tyranny, the fangs come out. If you don't challenge them, the grin remains. So that's, at least we've accomplished that. Yes?
Yes, Mr. Nader, I have read that the original corporations in this country were created for specific tasks, such as building railroads, building roads, big projects that the country needed at the time. And then the corporation was abolished after the task at hand was finished. Well, now, as you have very eloquently detailed, corporations are basically strangling us at every turn, every facet of our lives. When I was a kid in the 50s, we had a few large corporations in the commercial world. We had Sears and we had Penny's and we had what we called monkey wards. But we didn't have Walmart. We didn't have the raft of corporations we have now. My question is, should we be going to the heart of the problem and abolishing the statutory corporate structure that even makes them possible and force all businesses to be small mom and pops, partnerships, that type of organization? And if we shouldn't abolish them, what are the principles that you would say should be in place so we can control corporations?
Well, the antitrust laws are one answer. There are certain corporations should be broken up because they have too much market power. The second answer is, what's the economies of scale? A lot of these giant corporations are way beyond what is necessary for maximum economies of scale in mass production. Third is, they should not be too big to fail and have the taxpayer bail them out because as Senator Sanders from Vermont said the other day, if they're too big to fail, they're too big to exist. And unfortunately, the Sherrod Brown bill, which was to cut down the size of the big banks so they are no longer too big to fail, they can be allowed to fail, was defeated by a combination of Republican votes and the Obama administration. Those are three criteria. There are other that are more dramatic. I favor paying attention. This requires a real political movement to do what you suggested, even part of what you suggested, to put a limit on bigness. I mean, that's one of the platforms of populism in our country, you know. Bigness. It reaches a level where it has characteristics completely different from small business capitalists. Big business violates the basic principles of capitalism. Number one, if you own something, you should control it. Big business is owned by shareholders. They have no power to control the bosses. The bosses control the whole operation and perpetuate themselves and rig the system. Number two, big business, if it is mismanaged or it can't meet the market test, doesn't have to go bankrupt the way a small business. It goes to Washington for a bailout. Violation of capitalist principle number two. Capitalist principle number three is if you don't like a competitor, you try to be better for the consumer and drive your competitor out of business because you got a better product or a better service. How does big business do it? When they have small business competitors, they try to go to Washington and rig the system in a way that burdens small business and less big business through tax systems and so forth, or they use predatory practices that are not market meritorious. Okay? Three principles of capitalism. These are not capitalists. They're corporate statists or corporate socialists. They privatize their profits and socialize their losses like Wall Street did. Since you raised the question, there's a wonderful paragraph by Chief Justice Marshall. Do we all remember him? See, it's in this book, by the way. And here it is. This is 1819 in the Dartmouth College case, Supreme Court. Justice John Marshall, quote, "A corporation is an artificial being, invisible, intangible, and existing only in contemplation of law. Being the mere creature of law, it possesses only those properties which the state charter of its creation confers upon it, either expressly or as incidental to its various existence." End quote. Take that, Scalia. Take that, Roberts. Take that, Thomas. You see? They had it right then, but they became so immersed in our consciousness that we gave up these curtailments on the artificial entity called the corporation and gave them all the constitutional rights we have except the Fifth Amendment. And you can never have equal justice under the law between you and ExxonMobil or you and DuPont or you and Pfizer under that system. Forget it. They have too many privileges and immunities you'll never have, even if you have $1 billion in your bank account. And this is why the point I make about growing up corporate instead of growing up civic, growing up corporate, looking at the world through these advertisements, the shaping of the corporate world that we're enveloped in, to a point where we don't even know what we own as a commonwealth. You ask your neighbors, what do we all own together as Americans, and see what they say. Do they say one-third of America, the public lands? Do they say the public airways over which TV and radio stations monopolize our property and pay us no rent? Do they say trillions of dollars of research and development, our tax dollars, that built all these companies who brag as if it was their own investment dollars and genius that did it? So we don't even talk about our commonwealth. Well, if we own the greatest wealth of this country, which is the case, and we do not control it. We've relinquished control to so much of the gold, silver, timber, molybdenum, you name it, to these corporations. We've lost enormous leverage to shape the future of our country. And I can tell you, I went 4 years college, 3 years law school, and they never had that as a discussion. See how we grow up corporate? You grow up corporate making sure that you don't confront and understand reality that could upset the power structure. That's why, until recently, law schools never had a course on corporate crime. They had a course on crime, but it's street crime. And then sometime in April, they had white-collar crime where a teller rips off a bank. They didn't have environmental courses. They didn't have civil rights courses. They didn't have consumer law courses. They were training their students to go into the corporate law firms to defend corporate power, which they do very well. See, that's growing up corporate. And you can just run through examples yourself. I looked at cars when I was a kid, just the way the auto companies wanted me to look at cars. Horsepower, speed, and style. Never fuel efficiency, safety, or pollution control. And if millions of us grew up that way, why should we demand anything else than a psychosexual metallic beast with 400 horsepower? You know, and crummy repair records and 16 miles per gallon car. See what I mean? Growing up that way. So I'm glad you asked the question. Thank you very much.